Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found online at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org a week after they air, and you can contact us for questions, concerns, whatever, at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's show features an interview with Adam, a friend and supporter of Luke O'Donovan. Luke's trial for defending himself against the queer bashing on New Year's Eve a year and 8 months ago will be starting on Tuesday, August 12th at 8:45 a.m. in Atlanta. More info on the case can be found at letlukego.wordpress.com. Following that conversation, we'll be speaking with a supporter of the 5E3, who's a personal friend of Amalie and Fallon. We talk about the case of Amalie Carlos Fallon, three anarchists facing charges relating to the arsoning of a government ministry building in Mexico City this last year, as well as the burning of a neighboring Nissan dealership. We'll talk about the Mexican prison system, the political context within which insurrectional anarchism in Mexico is traversing, about Prisoner Justice Day in Canada and abroad, and much more. We'll even touch briefly on the case of Nikki Kish, an anarchist convicted of stabbing and killing a college student while among a group of college students who were attacking homeless folks in Toronto. More on Nikki's case can be found at www.freenyki.org. More on the 5E3 can be found at www.abajolosmuros.org. That's abajolosmuros.org. And again, if you're in Asheville, North Carolina, be sure to feel free to drop by if you care to. Rosetta's Kitchen tonight at 8 p.m. The Upstairs at 8 p.m. there will be a potluck and also presentation by a friend of the 5E3 about that case. And also someone will be speaking on the case of Luke and how to get involved in supporting Luke. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
I've been locked up for 23 years, roughly. I've eaten more than 25,000 consecutive meals in state custody. And that means I've likely developed an immunity to just about every foodborne pathogen known to humans. Bacterial, fungal, viral, you name it. Considering everything my digestive tract has been exposed to, I could probably eat machine parts, lead paint, with a side order of radioactive isotopes, and I'd end up pooping out a tiny x-ray machine. Whenever people write to me, the two most popular topics for inquiry are prison rape and prison food. Free world people seem concerned most about what's getting shoved into either end of human cabinet. Let's talk about the food. It's the evolution of prison food delivery. With each successive improvement, the food situation has gotten markedly worse. I can foresee a scenario where, if food service improved much more, all 50,000 of us Ohio captives could die of malnutrition or food poisoning before the end of the next contract cycle. And that's coming from the guy who could snack on radioactive isotopes. Cesium-137, please. Mustard, hold the relish. When I first got locked up, prisoners ran food service. Prisoner clerks even ordered the supplies, kept the accounts of budget. On the chow line, every item but the main course was self-serve. If you wanted, you could grab a whole loaf of bread and scoop an entire pan of mashed potato. The catch, of course, is that whatever you took, you better eat. At the end of the meal, when you tossed your metal fork and spoon into the bucket near the exit, the shakedown guard would watch you dump your tray. Throwing away food would lead to consequence. From the perspective of the current regimen, that system is considered poor resource management. Food budgets were higher. Of course they were. But administrators weren't just buying more mashed potato. Prisoners had full stomachs. They were less irritable. The segregation unit was always half empty. The prisons ran themselves, and administrators were merely spectators. Then the system evolved. There was a move to hire in more administrators with a business orientation, to streamline costs, centralize or universalize everything, including the statewide menu. All expenditures were scrutinized by these new administrators like Caliconte, the former warden at Toledo, who has a business degree. He didn't know rehabilitation from basket weaving, but he could cut the budget on mashed potato. All menu items were portioned out by civilians, whose job security was dependent upon reducing portion and cutting costs. Yeah, misconduct and disruption increased dramatically, and the segregation units were overflowing with prisoners slated for higher security, which is always more expensive per prisoner. What the business wonks didn't factor in was that their savings in the food budget simply cost them more in other ways. Newsflash, hungry, angry, desperate prisoners are less manageable. With the spike in behavior problems, they built a multi-million-dollar supermax, where the cost to house each prisoner is considerably higher than any other institution. In one sense, OSP was built out of mashed potato. With the court-mandated healthy heart diet, the state found an excuse to cut portions again, without making the diet any healthier. I described the toxicity of that diet in my dean, not fit for human consumption. But the latest evolution is to outsource food to the Aramark Correction Services Corporation. Philadelphia-based Aramark's profit motive directly conflict with its mission to provide food service. Profit margins for Aramark increase the more they skimp on portions and lower food quality. So really, Aramark isn't in the food service business. Aramark is in the profit business. Just like the managers of Auschwitz and other Nazi concentration camps, Aramark's private interests are served by causing malnutrition, starvation, and death. Aramark makes money by producing hungry, angry prisoners, damaging their health, and taxpayer spend. On top of it, Aramark has gotten caught in a consistent pattern of corruption and ripoffs, as detailed in an AP story by Julie Carr Smith on June 14, 2013, and again by the Columbus Dispatch's Randy Ludlow on April 19, 2014. Two stories that obviously only skim the surface of a much deeper problem, since we know that the mainstream media is to truth what Aramark is to food. My own documented run-in with Aramark will soon be posted at SeanSwing.org and on Facebook. So, don't be surprised when Ohio outsources the digging of mass graves to a private landscaping firm in order to bury the victims of Aramark's malnutrition scam. Mass grave, the wave of the future. In the meantime, can you pass those isotopes? I'm starving.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville hyphen Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with a support person for Luke O'Donovan, whose trial is now set to begin Tuesday of this week. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi there. My name's Adam Wadley from Atlanta, Georgia.
Can you tell briefly about Luke's case?
Sure. Luke was at a New Year's Eve party on New Year's Eve of 2012 to 2013, and he was seen at this party kissing other men and flirting with them. Other people at that party did not like that and confronted him about it. And the ensuing confrontation led to the violent altercation. Luke was attacked and defended himself, and what happened, eventually fled in fear of his life. Then the police came, and since Luke was gone and all of the only people left were his assailants, the police got their side of the story, and Luke received charges for defending himself.
How many people attacked him?
Well, there were five people that were injured by Luke's self-defense, but from reports, there were five to eight people who were attacking him.
Can you talk about why Luke isn't pressing charges on his attackers? Isn't that a dangerous strategy for Luke's safety?
Yeah, to be sure. If we actually believed that the justice system was a system of justice, then by all means, it would be Luke's attackers who would be facing jail time because they attacked him for no good reason, simply because they didn't appreciate who he was into or whatever. But Luke isn't trying to use the violence of the state or isn't trying to press charges against these people just because he doesn't believe that that is a way to get justice in this world. I mean, real justice or reconciliation would be just something else. And Luke is definitely afraid of the jail time that he's facing, but just doesn't want to turn back that same violent mechanism on his attackers.
Exactly how much jail time is Luke facing?
Luke is facing 5 felony counts of aggravated assault and 1 count of felony attempted murder. If the jury convicts him on all the charges and the judge decides to be as harsh as he can be or as she can be, then Luke would definitely be in jail for the rest of his life. Each of the aggravated assault charges can carry a maximum sentence of 20 years. And I'm not familiar with the felony attempted murder charge, but 5 times 20 is 100. And that would basically be a life sentence. So Luke is facing going away for the rest of his life for defending himself at this party. But it's not really surprising because there's a whole culture of homophobic assault and also transphobic, just gender and sexuality, gender and sexual-based violence, which is going through Atlanta right now. There have recently been 2 instances in which trans people, trans women in particular, have been assaulted in broad daylight with no repercussions. And in one of those instances, there's actually a video of one of the people who attacked Luke, who is a bystander to another one of these assaults. So there's clearly a whole context of homophobic assaults going down.
What is the support committee calling for of people wanting to show solidarity with Luke?
Well, to anyone out there who is looking to support Luke, thank you. Luke is very scared at this time and can use all the support that he can get. At this time, Luke is in debt in his legal fees, and there is a link to his donation page if you go to letlukego.wordpress.com, where you can figure out how to donate money if you are interested in doing that. If Luke does eventually get convicted or does eventually go to jail, then Luke would very much appreciate any sort of correspondence, letters, anything like that would mean the world to him, just because he very well might go away for the worst of reasons. But in that circumstance, just a human connection would mean everything to him. If people are trying to get involved before the trial starts, people are more than welcome to visit. If anybody is in the Atlanta area or in a place where they would like to visit for the trial, they're more than welcome, and accommodation can be provided. Again, there's contact information on letlukego.wordpress.com in case anybody would like to visit. But yeah, like I said, either a monetary donation, visiting, making a showing in court, or like writing a letter if Luke does eventually go away. I believe there might also be a petition that people can sign that change.org in an attempt to show that Luke has community support and that people believe that he was indeed defending himself. They can go to change.org and search for Luke O'Donovan, and they'll find the petition, and they can sign on to that before the trial starts on Tuesday at 8:45.
And already over 1,000 people have signed this petition. Is there anything that you wanted to cover that we didn't cover?
Well, I guess I'd just like to say that it's really heartening for us as Luke's friends and people who are trying to support him through this really difficult and scary time to be receiving support and attention from people in other cities. And so I just am very grateful to you for having me on and for spreading the information about this one case, which is really hard for us to deal with, but it's really just a drop in the bucket of anti-queer and just oppressive violence generally that the world is going through. And if anybody feels it in their heart to help our friend go through this really difficult time, he would really appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. It's my pleasure. Go! We're speaking with a support person for the 5E3. Thanks for coming on and having this conversation.
Thanks for having me here.
Can you tell listeners about the case of the 5E3?
So the 5E3 are Carlos Lopez Marin, Amélie Trudeau, and Fallon Rouillet. They were arrested in Mexico City on January 5th, 2014, under suspicion of committing a Molotov attack on the Ministry of Communication and Transportation and the nearby Nissan dealership.
And can you tell a little bit about the individuals themselves?
Definitely, yeah. I'm a personal friend of Amélie and Fallon, and these are two anarchists who have been dedicated to a lot of different struggles, especially in Quebec, for many, many years. The projects that they've worked on, you know, mostly have been around anti-fascism, anti-repression, projects against prisons, against the police. They also are really interested in doing like distribution projects, printing projects. They've worked on various successful neighborhood anarchist social spaces. Carlos, I don't know personally, but I've just heard that he's super cool and super dedicated insurrectionary anarchist in Mexico. And he has a six-year-old daughter. And, you know, his strength is definitely an inspiration.
Can you talk about the conditions of their incarceration? Listeners may be familiar with stories of prisons in the U.S. and even possibly Canada, but the Mexican penal system seems very different.
Yeah, so the first 40 days that they were incarcerated were in a special center called the Arrego Center, which is basically where the government detains people without charges while they're under investigation. And while they were in the Arrego, they were under pretty harsh conditions. They had about, you know, 23-hour-a-day lockdown. They were allowed very, very, very brief periods for phone calls and cigarettes and food, you know, 5 minutes at a time. It was pretty harsh. Since they've been transferred after those 40 days into the, you know, regular sort of like local jails, the women's prison seems to be fairly relaxed where Amélie and Fallon are, just in terms of like, you know, we can bring them in quite a lot of things. The visits are quite long. It seems like they have a lot of time to do what they want to do. Although one thing is that the prisons don't really feed them food, which is pretty intense. They have to basically pay for everything. It costs a lot of money to keep them in jail there, which is just the most insane thing to ever think about. Carlos's conditions seem a lot worse. He's facing a lot of extortion from other prisoners, so it's expensive for him to be in prison for that reason, just because of the amount of violence that he faces.
Despite Amélie and Fallon's attempts to not use their citizenship in Canada as some sort of like shield that Carlos wouldn't have access to, are you aware of much, or can you talk about like differences besides being in differently gendered prisons, like differences in how they're being prosecuted that you're aware of?
Yeah, I'm actually not really sure.
Okay.
I would say that definitely like Amélie and Fallon could have used their Canadian citizenship privilege in order to like try and gain some kind of clemency. But rather than doing that, they've just continued to call for solidarity from anarchists. They've continued to just want to like spread anti-capitalist anarchist struggle against prison in its totality and are not interested in reforming their own personal case for them to be able to get off. But they do want to come home.
Yeah. I think you had told me before that it was one of Carlos's letters used the phrase ni inocentes ni culpables, translating to neither innocent nor guilty. And with what you said about not really hedging their like words around the case, can you talk about the context that you see between the three of them and the idea of innocence and guilt?
Oh yeah, definitely. I have this letter from Carlos here that actually just explains it so good that I don't want to do it myself. So in the words of Carlos, this was written back in March. This was part of Carlos's first letter that he wrote. He says, "Today they brought us to declare, expecting us to declare ourselves innocent or guilty. On this point, I want to openly make something clear. Personally, I do not accept either one of these two positions. Guilty, innocent, that would give legitimacy to the stupid laws of the state of which I do not recognize the authority. After all, the state and its laws are just generators and regulators of privileges, injustices, exploitation, and domination."
Were there other words by the folks that you wanted to read from?
Well, I guess I just want to really just help to express to folks how inspiring this is for me, and I think for a lot of anarchists in Canada and across the world, you know, because Fallon, Carlos, and Amelie have really remained strong. They've remained uncompromising. Throughout their detention, they've continued to send letters that could be translated and publicly spread to share their commitment and their refusal to cooperate, their dismissal at the very concept of guilt and innocence, their disgust with the world of prisons, laws, and police. So yeah, rather than compromising their position at any point, they've continued to call for a spread of insurrectional practice. In times of repression, solidarity includes attack as much as it includes fundraising. That's something that I think is really important to take home here.
Well stated. And so is there basically like a marketplace inside of the prison? And to your understanding, what happens if somebody doesn't have family or friends that are bringing them things inside?
Well, for instance, with Amelie and Fallon, you know, we can't bring them in their food every day, obviously. So we do offer, all of them have like a stipend that's being fundraised, and they can buy food from other prisoners as well who do have family members bring them in food. So yeah, basically there's a huge marketplace. A lot of people sell, a lot of the prisoners are selling things in there, including food, including clothing, all kinds of things like that. So they can pretty much get whatever they need as long as they have the money for it.
And I would assume in a situation like a prison, if one didn't have access to that support coming from the outside. Oh, and when you say we, you're talking about support folks up in Quebec who wouldn't be able to come in daily and bring the food into them, right?
Yeah, at this point, the support crew in Quebec is pretty, you know, is definitely coordinated with folks from like Mexico ABC and other folks down there. So I think we is a little bit broader. Okay. Yeah, with folks down there as well.
But if somebody doesn't have access to those resources or things getting brought in and they have to eat, does that just mean that they have to be hired on by other people for like sex work or for bodyguard status or for stuff like that?
I'm not really sure, but yeah, I'm assuming so. You know, I think that it's just a huge hustle. Like you find things that you can sell and, you know, some people make money by like setting up their sheet outside for shade during visits. You know, people have like all these I've just heard the most crazy stories of like the ways that people make money. And I think that it's just, you know, people have to figure it out. It sounds like most people do.
Can you talk a little bit about where the case is at?
Definitely. So after they got out of the Arago, the 40-day detention, they were charged with damages and attacking the public peace. So those charges, you know, would carry, I think the minimum, it's like a minimum of like 5 years or so in Mexico, although those kinds of things are very hard to understand. So when they were being held in the jails where they've been, they were also notified on May 16th that they had new charges under a federal order. And that charge is arson on a building with persons inside. So they actually have two sets of charges now, the local charges being the damages and public peace charges, and then the federal charge being the arson charge. So this basically means now that they're facing two different criminal proceedings. Both of the trials are basically finished at this point. We don't actually have word that they've been convicted on any of those charges. It's unclear when we actually find that out. It seems like we basically just wait for sentencing, which is whenever the judge is ready. So it's really like there isn't really a very specific timeline on that.
Can you talk about what types of support and solidarity the 5E3 are getting at this point? Like you've mentioned the varied network of people that are sending money down there, but what other forms of solidarity and support are they receiving?
Yeah, I mean, definitely fundraising is really important. Right now we have a budget of about $200 a week Canadian, which is to support the very, very basic needs of all three of them, Carlos, Amelie, and Fallon. And also with some money to go towards Carlos's kid. So that's a really important thing to keep going. We have a lot of care packages going down, so making sure that they have reading material, that they have clothing, just like the things that they are, you know, wanting to engage with. All of that can be really, really awesome support. There's also been like, I don't even remember all of the solidarity actions that have happened, which have, you know, been actions all around the world that have been claimed in solidarity with them. So one of the most recent ones was an attack at a Nissan dealership in Olympia, Washington, sometime in the last couple of weeks. So that was, you know, claimed in solidarity with them. Over the last 6 months, you know, there's been police cars attacked, banks attacked, all kinds of things have happened in solidarity with them as well.
And so that form of solidarity in particular, of often described as revolutionary solidarity, can you talk about the importance of revolutionary solidarity and what that looks like?
Definitely. Yeah. You know, I think that for me and for, you know, I think that Amelie and Fallon would probably share this view, although I can't speak for them, really is that revolutionary solidarity is actually just a part of having struggles against capitalism, where as we struggle for our freedom, we're struggling with our imprisoned comrades in mind, where we remember them, we don't forget them, but ultimately that we're actually carrying on our own struggles in the places that we live. And our struggle doesn't have to be, you know, on behalf of them. Our struggle doesn't become just that there's these prisoners, you know, that in its sense actually recuperates our own struggles for freedom. What we actually want to see is that we have these struggles that are ongoing, that are actually can gain strength through solidarity with each other, through not forgetting people inside. And that can also look like, you know, just making sure that they're kept in the loop about what's going on outside in terms of struggle too, and that they can still gain inspiration from the struggles going on.
What can listeners do to support them further, like outside of the revolutionary solidarity and the fundraising that we mentioned? And where can they get more information about the case?
So these are things that are slowly coming together. You know, the communication can be difficult between just with the way that this is such an international case. There's somewhat of a clearinghouse that was on Sabotage Media, but that website recently actually ended. The Fuego a la Carceles website actually stopped updating at some point as well. The Cruz Negra, the Anarchist Black Cross Mexico, does update in Spanish. So if people can read Spanish, they can go on the Cruz Negra Mexico website.
And there's always that evil Google Translate or Babelfish or Yahoo Translate that do an okay job.
Definitely, yeah. I would say keep your internet eyes peeled. There, you know, ideally, fingers crossed, should be some better updates coming, potentially a website, etc.
And also War on Society has translated a bunch of the letters from French and Spanish into English.
Yes, War on Society is awesome.
As an Anarchist Black Cross member, have you seen the international nature of this case draw different forms of support for the folks from other cases, for instance?
I think that one thing that really sparks a difference for me with this case than with other cases that I've worked closely with is that this is a case that's really explicitly asking for solidarity for people who identify as insurrectionary anarchists, which I think has happened in North America before, for sure. But I think this is like really, it can definitely bring a different energy to it where there really is a sense of like, I really get a sense of their defiance from cooperating with the legal system or like the consulate or like being treated especially Amelie and Fallon being from Canada. So I do think that that is a really interesting dynamic going on. And also in terms of the connections that are being created, you know, having friends go to different countries and getting arrested definitely is a way of like having really strong, solid bonds being formed between people in different countries. So I think that's really positive too.
Not that we're condoning that people go to other countries and get arrested. The point should be to not get arrested.
True.
More on the case of the 5E3 and prisons in Mexico after this music break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Final Straw on Asheville FM. We are coming back into our conversation with a supporter of the 5E3, three anarchists facing charges and currently imprisoned in Mexico, accused of the arsoning of a government ministry of transportation and communication and also neighboring Nissan dealership.
I think that, you know, because of language barriers, because of different, you know, political contexts, a lot of folks in Canada and the U.S. don't necessarily actually know about the struggles that are going on there. Ongoing. So I guess is interesting and important to me to note that Amelie and Fallon traveled to Mexico for an international convergence of insurrectionary anarchists in December. And that gathering in December followed a pretty heavy escalation of tactics by anarchists in Mexico. A lot of bombings were happening. Like they were really, really essentially just escalating the tactics used against the state there. So that's the context, I think, is just important to think about. Another thing to think about is just the context in Mexico politically is really different. You know, it's such that the state doesn't actually have so much power. There's a lot of corruption. There's militias. There's the drug cartels, etc. So the anarchists in Mexico don't just have the state as their enemy. It's also the communists. It's the narcos, etc. So all of those groups are against anarchy. And they all use violence regularly against anarchists and against anarchist projects. So this corruption actually seems to make for a context where it's not always clear who the enemy is. Is it the government? Is it the narcos? Who's paying who? People disappear from prison. You know, there's not really accountability there. It's especially outside of the federal district of Mexico City. You know, there's just this corruption that creates a very ambiguous situation.
And there's, like, it sounds like within DFA in particular, like within Mexico City, I've heard about tons of insurrectional strains, like whether it be people using the alphabet soup of like FAI, ELF, ITS, nihilist and insurrectional anarchist politics seem really like amazingly hardcore in that city and in surrounding areas.
Yeah, they've definitely taken off there a lot, you know, in the past few years, those politics. And there's also people doing like so many different kinds of projects. It seems like it's a really politically diverse place, which is really interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about what, I mean, there's some like obvious things that you could point to as to why those two places were assaulted, why the police would accuse anarchists of doing those things. But the Nissan dealership and the government ministry of communications and transportation, right? Has anything been said about motivations by the people who actually perpetrated the crimes?
There was actually never any communiques that have gone out about those attacks, to my knowledge, that have been translated anyway.
Yeah, it seems like when I hear stuff from Mexico, it seems like it's in kind of nascent form of what you read about coming out of Chile, just like extreme like social war being brought to the streets.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's really a lot of inspiration that a lot of folks across, you know, Latin America, Central and South America, that they really have a lot of really strong inspirations from each other, which is really cool. And I think, you know, in a way, it's like maybe it could be compared to like the U.S. and Canada and Europe or something. You know, there are these like international ties that exist in different places. They're not necessarily based on like human relationship. That's not what I'm implying. I'm more implying that the ideas in those cultural contexts that can be related to can spread.
It's really fascinating to see something like see a communique attached to an action that occurs in Russia that's referencing Indonesian like free eat and Billy or whatever. Like it's,
and I think, you know, one thing that is maybe like, you know, there's at the end of August coming up, there's this week of solidarity called with anarchist prisoners. I forget the exact dates of it, but that can be a really good time for people if they want to get together and just look more into these cases and just like understand what's going on more and understand the ideas behind like the motivations behind some of these actions and why people are in prison and also what they're doing from prison to, you know, maintain their dignity.
The day the show airs on Asheville FM is the 10th of August, and that's also known as, in Canada, as Prisoner Justice Day. Can you talk about that? What's that all about?
Yeah, I can definitely talk about that. Prisoner Justice Day is celebrated as a day to remember people who have died in prison, basically. And it's a day, I think internationally, but maybe more explicitly across Canada, where prisoners usually in many, many prisons across the country act collectively for their dignity. Prisoner Justice Day started because this person, Eddie Nolan, bled to death in the segregation unit of Millhaven Maximum Security Prison in Bath, Ontario. That was on August 10th, 1974. So on the first anniversary of his death in 1975, on August 10th, the prisoners at Millhaven refused to work. They went on a one-day hunger strike and held a memorial service. And many of them then spent a stint in solitary confinement. In 1976, it spread to basically entirely across Canada as thousands of prisoners went on hunger strike as an act of defiance against prison, solitary confinement, and inhumane treatment. So to this day, prisoners commemorate not just the death of Eddie Nolan, but the death of all prisoners who have died in prison because of, you know, neglect or torture or whatever.
So I would imagine there's a lot of differences between the way that race and politics play out among prisoners in Canada, just because of the specific nature of racism in the United States as opposed to racism in Canada, and the way the institutions promote that. But has that holiday been taken up across the board, across all the different class, race, gender lines among the prisoners that participate, or is it mostly certain segments of the prison population that you're aware of?
Yeah, I've only had really sort of personal accounts from a few different prisoners. So I know that like at Grand Valley Institution for Women, which is the federal women's prison in Ontario, the maximum security unit there has often gone on hunger strike. The max unit is, you know, most of the like more quote unquote risky, dangerous, whatever prisoners, usually with like lower class background. A lot of Native women. A friend, Nikki Kish, is held there, and she's an anarchist, and so she usually organizes hunger and work strike there on Prisoner Justice Day. So that's, in a sense, like the sort of most, they're in like the most intense, cruel of situations of that jail specifically. I know that at Barton Jail, which is in Hamilton, Ontario, they usually have a few different units in different years. You know, I don't think it's every unit always goes on hunger strike, but usually a few of the different ranges do. A lot of the people who are in Barton Jail are super broke from like a sketchy steel city. You know, a lot of folks who are in Barton Jail are from Six Nations. I would definitely, in my understanding, it seems to be pretty across the board.
That must be pretty frightening for prison administration. I would imagine the idea of like all these people coming across whatever religious or whatever other like bound, like categories that they come from and identifying as, to use the term referencing the Lucasville uprising in the U.S., convict race.
I definitely don't guarantee that it's always that simple, but definitely it's a big threat for sure. I think that it has a lot of capabilities to really show the prison administration that, you know, they can't just go off with everybody and do whatever they want all the time. They get away with way too much as it is. And yeah, I mean, there's also a lot of consequences. You know, people definitely do time in the hole for participating in these hunger strikes. And they know that that's a risk and they, you know, they take it willingly.
Do you want to talk about Nikki Kish? Because I've seen Nikki's case come up on a few Canadian pages and like, you know, a few magazines out of Canada, but it really hasn't gotten very much coverage in the U.S.
I mean, Nikki's case is really heartbreaking, I would say.
Like a young anarchist who...
Yeah, she, you know, she, at the time of her arrest, was a young punk organized in a lot of, like, anti-poverty kind of campaigns in Toronto. You know, really, like, a vibrant, amazing community organizer.
An artist.
Yeah, musician. Artist, poet, musician. And... yeah, she got charged and convicted of the murder of a bro, essentially. Her friends who were, like, you know, panhandling on the street were attacked by a group of, like, college students, like, college jocks. And one of them was stabbed to death. You know, essentially, there is basically no evidence that Nikki had any part in that. And she, you know, she was arrested and charged and convicted because she was also stabbed, which put her at the scene. She just lost an appeal, actually, about... gosh, in the last few months, she lost her appeal. She had a retrial. So that was a really heartbreaking thing. She got sentenced to like 11 or 12 years. And so I mean, she still got She's still got a long way to go, but her continuation of her struggle to, like, not just be an anarchist, but, like, really be herself inside that prison is really, really inspiring.
Can you say a few words about who the prosecutor for that case was?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But what I do remember is that when she was arrested and charged, it was in the context of when the municipal government in Toronto was trying to pass the Safe Streets Act, which was criminalizing, panhandling and, you know, sign flying and all of that. So it was really, like, in a very tense political context of really cracking down on just, like, the street life in Toronto.
I think I remembered reading, and I might be incorrect about this, that Giroux was, if I'm remembering correctly, the person's name, but that main detective that was prosecuting and harassing anarchists around the G20 case.
That sounds right, yeah. Giroux. That person makes me feel so many things. Yeah. I think we actually usually call him Giroux, but that might just be a weird, like, Canadian pronunciation. But yeah, he was definitely one of the prosecutors in the G20 case, and it makes sense that he was Nikki's, but yeah, I don't specifically remember that. So if you want to search that case, you can search Nikki Kish, N-Y-K-I-K-I-S-H.
So if people wanted to make monetary donations to Amélie Fallon and Carlos, where would they go on the interwebs to be able to donate?
So there's a group in Montreal that's collecting money to send to Mexico. The group is CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence Montreal. So the website is www.clac-montreal.net. That's CLAC-montreal.net. You could /EN for English if you prefer English. You can search on there donations. And when you make a donation to CLAC, just make sure that you're specifying that your donation is for the 5E3, and it will go into their 5E3 fund. And that money is going towards the basic needs, like the sort of daily basic needs of Amélie Fallon and Carlos.
What kind of stuff do the three like receiving in the mail if someone were to write them? Are there addresses that are posted up anywhere? And can you talk about what kind of, like, stuff interests them?
Amélie and Fallon's first language, both of them, is French. And I think that they would actually super, super appreciate books and things to read in French. That could be, like, queer literature or, you know, political literature, like historical anarchist things, whatever you think that they might like. Though anything in English, Spanish, or French really is fine. So reading materials are great. It takes a few weeks for letters to get in, and definitely, you know, sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, you can always try sending something again. They can receive zines and photocopies in the mail. They can receive books in the mail.
Are there any worries about staples in the zines? Is that something?
No.
I mean,
strange.
If you can also, like, send them, I think that's just a BS thing to make, to yeah, internalize the prison system and the people who are sending stuff into prison. And they can receive burned DVDs and CDs also, right?
Yeah, and I'm not actually sure if they can get those in the mail or if we're going to have to, if we have to bring them in to them directly when we visit. But that's like an unconfirmed rumor, I would say, is that they can get burned CDs and DVDs. So if you feel like making them, like, you know, a mix anti-cop hip-hop or something like that, I'm sure that that would be greatly appreciated.
Do you want to read a little bit from that Fallon letter?
Yeah, I will. So this letter from Fallon was written at the end of March this year, and it was translated. It was written in sort of a combination of French and Spanish, so this is a translation. I'm just going to read the first little bit. I want to begin this letter with a huge hug for all the compas who are on the run, all those who are fighting for their liberty, and all those who are locked up and for whom this world of domination is trying to quell their rage. There is no cell, no wall, no authority to whom I give enough power to quiet my rage and my desire for freedom. I've had these feelings since I was a little one, and now in my heart and my head, they are stronger than ever, and there isn't a day that goes by where I don't think of you guys, my friends. I can imagine, and they tell me as well, that the situation outside is very precarious. This doesn't surprise me, as us deciding to be in conflict comes with repression. It isn't simple, it isn't easy, and there are many emotions that are all mixed up, but the specific emotion that we all have in common is our force, individually and collectively. No one can cage this feeling, neither a prison nor a border. She has a part of her letter, I'm just going to skip down a little ways, just to describe. She does a little bit of describing the jail, and it's with a sense of humor, not because it's not a serious situation. I think that it's more so just because she says here, "And here in Santa Marta, there are many neighborhoods from A to H. There is a park, apartments, and neighbors. There's a corner store, sex workers, drugs everywhere. There are people who reproduce the gender roles of girls and boys, and there are also tons of babies. There is a school, a doctor, a court. There are studies to classify us in Santa Marta. There is corruption, formal and informal power, schedules, and many emotions, many histories, lots of time to share together, rage, and definitely lots of cigarettes and coffee to share. If it isn't already clear," here my Spanish fails me a bit, she says, "but now Santa Marta is my new city. A is my new neighborhood, 107 is my new apartment, and Amelie my neighbor. For me, this is clearer than any theory." If you want to write to them, their addresses are available on the Cruz Negra website. Just search Google, like Cruz Negra Anarquista, or CNA Mexico. So that's the Anarchist Black Cross, Mexico City. So you can find the mailing addresses on their website. Cool. And they're being super solid and amazing throughout all of this.
As you've expressed by reading some of the letters, it's pretty clear that all three of the 5E3 are like very talented communicators, impassioned writers, and have a lot to say and a lot of insights. If people want to find out more about their conditions and what's going on, their cases and their personal perspectives and daily lives, what can they do?
Yeah, all of their letters are available translated into English, French, and Spanish. You can find them on waronsociety.noblogs.org or sabotagemedia.anarchia.org. Anarchia has a K-H-I-A, but you could search Sabotage Media in Google. So some of the letters that could be interesting to read. Carlos wrote a letter about his situation in prison, about his conditions, which really just outlines how intense the conditions are for him in jail there, the kinds of ways that that institution functions and how disgusting it is. Amelie wrote a letter as well that you can find there. Carlos has a brand new letter and one from the beginning. You can find those there as well. And Fallon has two letters. So those are all the letters that have been made public for people to read so that you can understand better their perspectives and the kinds of things that they're thinking about and just what's been going on for them.
Thanks a lot for having this conversation.
Thanks for having me on the show here. Appreciate it. And everyone should keep their ears open for hopefully in the future we'll be able to set up a time for Amelie and Fallon to do an interview as well.
That'd be great. And keep their ears out for changes in the court case as things progress and people start knowing more. As you said before, that like they actually don't know if they've been convicted or of what at this point, right? It's not
true.
Just people on the outside who are doing support, but
correct.
Cool. Transparency.
Yeah.
What the Mexican government's really known for. We've been speaking with a supporter of the 5E3, and more info on that case can be found at abajolosmuros.org. That's www.abajolosmuros.org. That's the website of the Cruz Negra Anarquista out of Mexico, the Anarchist Black Cross in Mexico, based out of Mexico City.
Sí, sí. Hola, hola. Bueno, hoy mientras nos encontramos en esta sala, en este concierto, pasándolo bien, disfrutando estos momentos entre compañeros y compañeras, no podemos olvidar a nuestros hermanos y hermanas presos y presas. No podemos olvidar que siguen prisioneros y prisioneras del odio fascista de todos los estados de todo el mundo. No podemos olvidar a Eduardo García Macías. No podemos olvidar a Matt Barley. No podemos olvidar a Teresa González, Claudio Labaza, Miquel Pontolillo, a Mumia Guyamán. No olvidamos a Nico Maciotis, ni a Thomas Meyer Fall. No olvidamos a Luis Cabeza Mato, ni a los miles de compañeros y compañeras antifascistas presos y presas en todo el mundo que mueren todos los días un poco, en cualquier parte del mundo. A pocos kilómetros de esta sala, cerca de nosotros y nosotras, siguen asesinando a nuestros compañeros y compañeras presos y presas, con la colaboración de los sindicatos carceleros, con la ayuda de tantos y tantos malnacidos, torturadores y asesinos de luchadores y luchadoras. Hoy nosotros y nosotras seguimos en la lucha. Volveremos a tomar las calles para sacar a nuestros compañeros y compañeras presos y presas. La lucha sigue, compañeros y compañeras. ¡No hay tregua! ¡Abajo los muros de las prisiones! ¡Abajo los muros!
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found online at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org a week after they air, and you can contact us for questions, concerns, whatever, at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.